E4E is brought to you by the University of Delaware Partnership for Public Education. In an effort to increase the availability and accessibility of UD expertise to Delaware's P12 educators, leaders, and policy influencers, we have invited faculty members from the University of Delaware's 9 colleges to share their research. We hope you enjoy today's critical conversation and consider ways you might be able to leverage relevant research and UD expertise to advance policy and transform practice.
Hello, my name is Dr. Anastasia Pernton. I'm the Associate Director of the Partnership for Public Education. I'll be the host for today's episode of the E4E podcast, which was produced by Sarah Daniels, a graduate student in the Biden School of Public Policy and Administration. In this episode, we catch up with Dr. Eric K. Leyland, an assistant professor in the Department of Human Development and Family Sciences at the University of Delaware. Eric works in LGBTQ plus developmental research, bridging his research to community impact through developmentally informed affirmative interventions. Eric's specific research areas of interest include LGBTQ plus with in-group differences in mental health and unhealthy substance use, the impact of stigma on LGBTQ plus development, strength-based approaches to LGBTQ plus health, and affirmative interventions. Eric will be discussing some of his research in multidimensional stigma amongst sexual minority men of color, as well as the impact of intersecting sources of stigma in the sexual and gender minority community. Eric, it's so wonderful to have you on the podcast today. Thank you for being here with us.
Thank you for having me. I'm super excited to be here in this conversation. So before we get started, I want to preface that one of the words I'm going to use today is queer. And I use this as a term that is all-encompassing and inclusive for a lot of diverse identities in the LGBTQ plus community. And so it can refer to folks who have a sexual orientation other than heterosexual, even if there's not a specific identity label. It can also refer to folks whose gender doesn't fit into a single box, as well as folks with a variety of labels that we may be more familiar with, such as gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgender. So I just wanted to give that heads up that when I use that word, it's intended to be an umbrella an inclusive term to represent the diversity of our LGBTQ plus community.
My first question for you is, how are the effects of racism, heterosexism, and stigma related?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we know that systems of oppression are overlapping in the ways that groups and people hold power to keep other groups marginalized and away from resources or being included are overlapping together, which means that the systems of racism, heterosexism, and other stigma together serve this like social goal of keeping groups out and away from resources. So for racism, that's specific to people of color who are outside of the white majority. And for heterosexism, that's referring to queer people, gay, lesbian, other people with sexual orientations outside of the majority to keep them away from resources, from power, and from being included or protected. And so overall, the idea of stigma is that there are identities or traits that people have that are devalued by a dominant culture, and that then the dominant group or the group with more power or majority uses that devaluation of people or their traits to keep them down and keep them away from resources, from protections, and from achieving the same power or access that the dominant group has.
So my next question, Eric, is what are socio-structural burdens and how do they impact health outcomes?
Yeah, that's a great question as well. So in some of the research I've done, I've referred to socio-structural burdens, but folks might use other terms to describe these burdens that folks experience. So in the research I've done, socio-structural burdens refers to things like housing instability and access, stable employment. It can also be whether people are engaging in survival behaviors, which is, for example, one might be engaging in transactional sexual behaviors to access housing or to access money to live. You can think also in terms of basic resources and the way that people interact with social systems to access those basic resources. So in terms of housing, for example, people may be needing to seek out housing support services or looking to share housing with friends or family members to find a safe place to stay and get that shelter. And when people don't have access to these basic needs, it can have consequences for their mental health and behavioral health and their long-term well-being. And so the reason we say socio-structural is because there's both person-to-person aspects of this and systems that individuals have to interact with, and that there can be these multiple burdens on housing, on food access, on employment, on wages that all converge together to have downstream impact on health through the added stress and instability that they create for individuals.
Eric, so we've seen in your research that you've used the term compound stigma to discuss intersectionality between racism, heterosexism. Could you just describe that for us and explain a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so we know that for queer people of color, that their lived experience often includes systems of racism and heterosexism and ways that people enact or mistreat them through racism and heterosexism. So that there are these broader contexts of these experiences of intersecting racism and heterosexism that might impact their health, impact their access to resources. And so what we have to think about is how these two different sources of stigma and stress come together. An intersectional perspective tells us that their experience would then be different than just one plus one, but that it's these own unique experiences of stress that might target, say, for example, a gay Black man or a queer Latina woman that is different than a straight Latina woman or a queer white Latina woman. And what we think about in terms of compound stigma is the way that racism and heterosexism come together to converge and create this permeating, far-reaching impact of many forms of racism and heterosexism. So in the research that I've done in partnership with Children's Hospital Los Angeles, we work with participants who are all Black and Latino sexual minority men or Black and Latino trans folks. And what we see is that for those participants who are experiencing racism and heterosexism from lots of different people and lots of different contexts, so maybe from work, from police harassment, from family, that these experiences of racism and heterosexism come together, they happen frequently, and that folks who have this pattern of lots of different types of stigma from different people, different places happening often, that they tend to have, on average, poorer health outcomes. So more unhealthy substance use, poorer mental health over time, and this higher socio-structural burden. So fewer access to important basic material resources. So when I say compound stigma, it's really about understanding the ways that racism and heterosexism converge to uniquely impact and harm queer people of color who are subjected to those compounding forms of mistreatment.
So could you talk a little bit more about how intersecting stigma is reflected in health disparities and development for Black and Latinx sexual minority young men?
Yeah, so a lot of what we know in terms of research on marginalized groups often takes a unidimensional or one identity approach, which is to say that we have a stronger body of research to understand the health disparities and determinants of those disparities when we compare, say, Black, white, and Hispanic groups, or when we compare LGBTQ to cisgender heterosexual groups. But these analyses and this research, though important to demonstrate disparities, leaves out the reality that for many people, they have multiple intersecting marginalized identities. So that to be a queer person of color is different to be a white queer person. And so understanding how living in a society that there's both visible and invisible forms of racism and heterosexism, to see how those come together and impact queer people of color is essential to using research to tell the whole story and to reflect the lived experiences of queer people of color and the reality that their experiences are different at times than white queer people. And in terms of health disparities, we see queer people of color have elevated rates of suicide attempts compared to heterosexual people of any race group. And when we don't take this intersectional perspective and consider how racism and heterosexism come together to impact queer people of color and their health, we miss some of that information by grouping them together in these one identity, single dimension groups. So it allows us to uncover the diversity of lived experiences of young people and adults by understanding their multiple identities and the way that those identities may be treated differently and thus impact their health in the long term. And then we can also think in terms of the positives. So yes, there's a converging of stigma and that that multiple marginalization may harm people, but there's also a lot of strengths and thriving to be found at the intersections of these communities and identities. And so I also think that that's very important to highlight, that queer people of color are drawing on their own histories of resistance, of thriving, and community that can create unique resources that are accessible within those communities that are protective and helpful to allow the flourishing of queer people of color as well.
So what gaps did you find in the current body of available research on intersecting sources of stigma that members of the sexual and gender minority community face?
When it comes to research and what we still need to do, people are using intersectional approaches more commonly in health and educational and social science research, and that these intersectional approaches can be traced back to Black feminist legal scholars and other Black feminist researchers and scientists, and really sticking to this core of what is meant by an intersectional approach. And then it's not enough just to say this identity plus this identity equals my health outcomes or a combination of those identities, but really thinking carefully about the systems of oppression and the way that people are treated and how that comes together. And we are seeing more research that does that. But in terms of LGBTQ research, that's still a growing area to think really carefully, not just about the identity markers that people have, but the diverse lived experiences they have. And because of that, we also have to think carefully about accidentally using research to suggest that just because people have the same identity labels, all of their experiences are the same. So if we take, for example, non-binary folks and we say, well, this is a type of issue that they experience, maybe it's getting misgendered, and we think that's important, and we think that that's the same stressor for all non-binary folks, instead of working with the data, with participants and community to understand the intersecting forms of stress that might be related to other identities and that might differ across subgroups of non-binary people based on other identities and experiences that they have. So I think looking to the future, that's some of what we need to do, is to really think carefully about how we describe people's intersecting identities and gather data that allows us to see their complex lived experiences. And then in terms of communicating that research, it's a more complex story to talk about the intersection of people's identities and the intersecting perhaps systems of oppressions or ways that people are mistreated, harassed, bullied, discriminated. But if we can move into that more complex space, we're also reflecting the realities of people better. But it can be a challenge to communicate science. And if the science is a little more complicated, researchers need to work a little harder to communicate that science better and help people understand why. Why now are we having better conversations in public health and education and social science that is attuned to these intersectional identities? It's not because they weren't there before and that people weren't experiencing these intersections before. People have always been intersectional. Discrimination has always been intersectional. But we're using new language and we have shifting culture that allows more of these conversations now in different spaces. And I think research is also moving to catch up with and keep pace with that so that we can understand the many ways that intersectional discrimination impacts folks. And then the last thing I might add on that is to really think developmentally in terms of the way that people's experiences of their identities, discrimination related to those identities, belonging to different social groups, that changes over time, that people evolve in the way they understand their identities, connections to those groups. And if we think of people and model them in our research as stagnant, as existing in one point in time, we then erase the reality of how people are moving to different places, they're interacting with different folks, and over time, that individual and the groups they belong to change. And by accounting for that change and development over time, we begin to highlight periods in life when experiences for folks on average might be different, when different types of discrimination or stigma are really harming people, or when people are developing a strong sense of belonging to a group that shares multiple identities and that may be particularly protective. So for example, in adolescence, we know that people's identities are shifting and changing and their belonging is really important. And that focus on identity and belonging might not be what we need to prioritize when we're studying LGBTQ folks, queer people of color in their 30s and 40s. So we need to recognize that that bringing in the developmental and the intersectional perspective together is just a bigger way of conceptualizing people's lived experience and mapping that into research.
We always end the podcast with a connection to Delaware and Delaware schools. And so my last question is, how do you think Delaware schools can be better equipped to address the negative effects of racism and heterosexism, especially for those groups that bear the brunt of multidimensional stigma, like sexual minority men of color?
Yeah, and one thing I would like to do first in response to this question is I'd like to commend Delaware policymakers and educators and advocates for Delaware being the only state in 2023, not to introduce anti-LGBTQ or anti-trans policy. It's really sad that there were more than 500 bills introduced last year across the country. Many of those did not make it to being enacted, but a lot did. And we watched over the year as more and more states introduced this policy. And towards the end of the year, seeing that Delaware was the only place in our country that didn't try to introduce this type of policy that harms LGBTQ people, especially LGBTQ youth, and many of those policies impacting an educational context and curriculum. So I think that's important to understand that Delaware is doing well in terms of policy that can impact the inclusion and belonging, the education and healthcare and educational access of queer people. And that a lot of times those policies disproportionately can prohibit and harm people who experience multiple marginalizations, such as LGBTQ people with disabilities, LGBTQ women, trans folks, people of color, and folks who may hold all of those identities. So I just wanted to start there with what Delaware leaders are doing well. And then there's also something in terms of policy that it's one step to not enact negative policy. It's another step to make sure that we're enacting protective policies. And Delaware has done some of that good work already in making sure that we have some policies on the book that are protective in spaces of education and healthcare in the state. But when we think about the reality that even when we have these policies in place and we have a good policy landscape generally for LGBTQ people in Delaware, that doesn't mean that there's no experiences of racism. There's still a general culture across the country, including in our state, that is guided by racism and the devaluation of people of color in different ways for different groups, that also privileges cisgender heterosexual people, and that can harm young LGBTQ people of color. And we see that can take effect or we can observe that in many different ways, in the ways that those identities are protected and included. So one of the things that is important in schools is that schools should have enumerated bullying policies that name race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, gender identity, and gender expression as protected groups. So we know that that's helpful and that can be protective for young people, but also that there are plans in place for action to take when those policies are violated. Are teachers prepared to step in as bystanders to intervene when they may see bullying based on race, ethnicity, or sexual orientation and gender identity? Are schools prepared to take action immediately to protect those students and to stop the behavior of students who are aggressive against against them. So I think that that is one important way to make sure that schools have both policy, but also administrative behavior to protect young people. And we have research evidence that shows that when we have that, that queer students feel a greater sense of belonging, a greater sense of school safety, they have higher school achievement, they're more likely to progress in their academic careers. And on the other side of health and well-being, that they have lower mental health issues and a stronger sense of self-esteem. In addition, there's also resources that schools can put in place to provide safe spaces and resources for students with marginalized identities, including queer people of color, which is to have things like a Gender and Sexuality Alliance, a GSA, in place at the school, providing a safe space, providing a mentor, providing a community for students to retreat to and to find that safe space. And schools and educators also really have to pay attention to how white those spaces are. Are they creating spaces that are only welcoming for white queer students, or are we making spaces that are representative and inclusive of queer people of color, and particularly of queer teens in schools looking for these resources? And this comes back to this conversation on intersectionality, is understanding as educators that the experiences of queer youth and queer students who are also people of color might be different than the needs of their white queer youth, and that it's easy in LGBTQ issues and is commonplace that white queer issues are centered first, and then queer people of color are considered later, if at all. And that's just not acceptable in terms of advocacy and activism. It's not acceptable in terms of educational resources or in research. And so Delaware can really be a leader in education in considering the ways that students of many identities, including at their intersections, are protected by policy, are supported by school resources, and are supported by their teachers and their mentors and staff to watch out for those things, to know that these lived experiences might differ and that the needs of students might be variable as well.
Eric, thank you so much. Before we finish the podcast, I just want to offer you an opportunity to tell us a little bit more about projects you're working on and if there's anything you'd like to share with our audience.
Yeah, so a couple of projects that I'm working on that we haven't discussed yet. So I just finished a project demonstrating that protective policy can impact the timing of when young people come out and share their sexual identity with others. And so I think it's great to focus on health, but we also see that these policies impact like identity development for young people, impact how comfortable and ready they are to come out and share that identity. And so what that gives us is a message of really, we can create environments that are warm and welcoming, whether we think at the state level, the school level, classroom, or one-to-one relationships, and that by creating those safer spaces and that communication and dialogue, we can allow LGBTQ young people to break out of perhaps isolation earlier and to seek resources and hopefully affirmation. And then there's a couple projects we have going on now that we're collecting data, including among folks in Delaware. One that we'll be wrapping up by the end of February is the Queer Joy Project, which is a national and international survey in the US and New Zealand for all LGBTQ folks over the age of 16 to share with us their experiences of what is positive about their identity, experience, and community of being a queer person. And our goal with this is to help push for a narrative that highlights the strengths and flourishing of queer people and not just what works against them or what's hard about being queer in a society that devalues an LGBTQ identity. And then the last one that we're just getting launched is the LGBTQ plus socialization project, which is focused on LGBTQ youth ages 13 to 20 and their parents or caregivers. And the goal of this project is to learn more about how the youth and their parents work together to understand their identity, to seek resources, and to become a family that provides affirmation and support for LGBTQ young people. So folks who are interested in that can certainly get in contact with me and my research team to see if they're eligible, but all across Delaware and neighboring states, LGBTQ youth and their parents would be able to sign up and participate in that study.
Awesome. And we'll have all of that linked in the description box for this podcast episode. So Eric, thank you so much for joining us today. This has been a wonderful conversation.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of E4E, brought to you by the University of Delaware Partnership for Public Education. For more information about the work being done by the Partnership for Public Education, please visit our website at www.udel.edu/PPE.